today on Doomed. 20 years since 9/11. 20 years of conspiracy theories. On today's episode of Doomed with Matt Binder, we will be taking a look at the aftermath, the fallout, as we approach the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. And we will be looking at all the conspiracy theories and the hoaxes that came out in the days, weeks, months, years that followed. Let me pull myself up on the screen here, ladies and gentlemen. And, you know, when I was putting this show together, I wasn't sure how to go about it. Because listen, let's put this up front. I usually avoid the 9/11 anniversary media. I don't watch all the movies, TV shows, interviews, books, whatever that come out in the ensuing, the 5th anniversary, 10th anniversary, 15th anniversary. We've had it 19 years now. And the reason for that is a lot of it always comes off to me as exploitative. Not all of it. Some of it is very well done, and I just avoid it because... I have watched some here and there, but a lot of it does feel exploitative. To me, there's no better example of the terror porn, that they show every anniversary than those networks that literally start each September 11th morning with a replaying of their broadcast from that day. Now it's going to be 20 years ago. I mean, why do we want to watch that? I never understood who watches that. Like, from a historical standpoint, I get if you seek out, it's important, obviously, to be able to go back in time and witness how people viewed news. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to study that. If anything, you know, even from a journalistic perspective, how it was covered in that moment and what we could learn from that. But you could do that. No, you could seek that out on your own. There's no reason you have to watch that the morning of September 11th with the minutes all, you know, queued up to the exact minute. I can watch that footage to do that, you know, educational class or piece in December, in May. It's very bizarre to me that networks have done that. And I felt, though, this time around, though, something about the 20th year anniversary to me seems like this is it in a way. Like, this is it in a way. Like, I feel like the 20th anniversary is the number where, hopefully, and I've read this a lot of, I feel like a lot of 9/11 families, at least the ones that I've read about, sort of feel the same way. Maybe now it can be, you know, people have lived in this 9/11 moment, I feel like, for 20 years. I mean, I feel for those families where they've had to share, you know, their loss, their grief with the rest of the country, the rest of the world, who feels like, you know, they have the same sort of connection to it. That always has seemed a little bit weird to me. I mean, it must be extremely hard to have to share that with people. That moment when your loved one is taken, and for 20 years now they've had to basically relive it with everyone else grieving in a way that I feel like isn't the equivalent to what they're going through. I mean, I read this amazing piece, really. I implore everyone read this piece. It is in the Atlantic, and it is by Jennifer Senior. I'm sorry if I'm saying her last name incorrectly. And the title of the piece is What Bobby McIlvain, I'm sorry if I'm getting that last name pronunciation wrong too, Left Behind. And it's about this McIlvain family who've basically lived with, for the past 20 years, the fact that their son, Bobby, died in the Twin Towers. He did not usually work there. He went to set up, help a co-worker set up for a conference that morning. It just so happened. And he was there in the restaurant, Windows of the World, if I recall. That's the name. Yeah, Windows on the World, excuse me. And he was just setting up this conference for his co-worker, and he was there. And his family have basically been grieving and living with this for the past 20 years. And for this specific episode, I mean, every member of this family, from the mother, the brother, the fiance, who he literally proposed to days before he died, all have extremely interesting experiences. And I'm, again, please go read this piece. I'll link to it in the YouTube. It's a very, very strong piece. But the father, to me, stuck with me because Bobby McIlvain's father, Bobby McIlvain Sr., he became basically a 9/11 truther. His way of mourning his son was to fight, well, what he viewed at least as fighting for his son in terms of fighting to find out what really happened. And he basically was convinced by a group called the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which is like a truth organization filled of various different like scientists and architects who basically, you know, use their know-how to convince people of these various conspiracy theories. Because, you know, knowing the terminology behind, you know, explosions and architectural information could be quite convincing to a layperson. And he basically came to the belief that there was, you know, 9/11 was an inside job, and there were explosives planted throughout the Twin Towers. And he actually believed that, for a long time, actually, his family believed that their son was actually leaving the World Trade Center due to the timing of everything. He had set up the event for his coworker and was leaving when the planes hit, and they think, due to the horrific autopsy results and how they found his body, that he was leaving, and he basically was hit by a piece of the plane, which is obviously horrible. But the father had all these questions based on where he was, you know, how he was hit, where the damage on his person was, and he basically believed his son was in there and there were explosives. And in the piece, actually, really interesting, the writer of the piece, Rebecca Senior, she actually finds out the timing. I'm sorry, Jennifer Senior. I don't know. I'm sorry for that slip. But she actually approaches him with evidence he never considered. I mean, this is a guy who for 20 years has been working on debunking the story of how his son died. And there was some very basic evidence he never considered, such as when the conference was supposed to take place, which would put a lot of the timeline in place for him. And it's just really amazing to, you know, to see that someone who dedicated their life to this just was so convinced by this group that they didn't seek out some very basics. And to me, it was just so eye-opening. I mean, that's I'm sure you'll find that same story repeated from family members of people who've fallen down the conspiratorial rabbit holes for any conspiracy, really. But I mean, just this past year with QAnon and, you know, people pushing the big lie, Trump's election fraud theories, and the, you know, the various different versions of the anti-vaxxer movement that believes, you know, COVID isn't real, which is obviously not true. It is. More people have died from COVID than on 9/11. And then you have, in this country at least, you know, and then you have people, you know, and there's a horrific story I'll maybe touch later on in the show about this guy who believed that this random family he came across were behind a sex trafficking ring. And so he showed up at their house at the middle of the night and he murdered 4 out of the 5 of them. They did not know him prior to him showing up at their door. It is, you know, incredible how people fall into these rabbit holes and their lives get taken over. But back to the 9/11 conspiracy theories, you know, again, read that piece. It is What Bobby McIlvaine Left Behind by Jennifer Senior in The Atlantic. But so today we will go through some of these conspiracy theories, some of these hoaxes, and sort of just discuss, because, you know, to me, the 9/11 truth stuff, obviously, I feel like, isn't as bad on its own as some of the stuff that came later on. As you'll see with Bobby McIlvaine Sr., I mean, his wife even says she doesn't believe a lot of this stuff. She believes some of it, but a lot of it she just didn't believe, but she doesn't have the heart to fight him on this, because who is she says, to tell a grieving father how to properly grieve for their son. Like, in his view, he is doing this for his son, in memory of his son. Like, that is strong. And I don't also, I mean, again, besides what it's doing to him, obviously, and his mental well-being, 20 years of doing this, I mean, it probably, as, you know, his wife, we became understanding, it doesn't really hurt anyone outside of the family, I guess. I mean, he became, according to this report, this story, I should say, like the 9/11 guy at family, at functions and you know, events they would go to, and he would talk. Like, this became like a sociable discussion for him too. It became sort of his identity, his personality formed around being this 9/11 truther. You know, it's you know, interesting just how conspiracy theories grew. And, you know, you could see some of the names, obviously. Alex Jones will come up if you bring up Loose Change, because he was behind, he wasn't involved with the first iteration of Loose Change, but like either the third, I think the third edition, he got involved, and he really helped make a name for himself early on as a 9/11 truther. And as you see, he goes from these really harmless conspiracy theories. A lot of the UFO stuff, I think, is harmless. You know, aliens existing. I mean, I feel like they do exist. I have no proof they've ever been here or any of the other conspiracies related around them. But I think it'd be quite presumptuous to believe that we are the only intelligent life, period. I mean, maybe not in our galaxy, not in our solar system, I should say. But I gotta believe that there is some sort of intelligent life out there somewhere, other than the human beings. But he goes from being this guy to becoming like the 9/11 truther, still, you know, not so hard. And then he goes into the Sandy Hook stuff and the Trumpism and the Pizzagate, QAnon, satanic ritual stuff. And then he's pushing the big lie and he's leading a group of people on January 6th. And, you know, it's just, you can see how this persona grows from these smaller bore conspiracies to who he becomes today. Excuse me, I needed to take a sip right there of some soda. But let's jump into some of this. I mean, probably when people think of 9/11 conspiracy theories, the first one that comes up is usually the inside job. And here's the thing. Like, I don't believe that, you know, the U.S. government planned the 9/11 attacks. Like, I don't believe in the explosion theory and that, you know, the Bush administration needed this so they could, you know, they needed to put this together so they could actually orchestrate the war in Iraq or, you know, the various invasions for oil or to enrich themselves in various other ways. Like, I don't believe the inside job conspiracy theory. However, I am very open and do believe myself in the idea that the Bush administration were derelict in doing what needed to be done prior to 9/11. The intelligence told them well before that Osama bin Laden was planning a terrorist attack in the U.S. And I don't know if they were blasé about it for what reason, but they were. They were. Like, they knew something was going to happen. The extent of what they knew, I don't know. But by all accounts, it does appear that they knew something was going to happen based on U.S. intelligence. And they just didn't follow up on it. They just did not follow up on it. And we all know what happens from there. Obviously, the hijackers carry out their mission. Two planes crash into each tower at the World Trade Center. Another plane crashes into the Pentagon. A fourth plane does not reach its destination, and it ends up crashing in a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Everyone on the flights die. 2,000 plus, close to 3,000 people, I believe, die in the Twin Towers. A couple hundred people die at the Pentagon. I think above 100, like 100 some odd, I think. And the Bush administration uses what happened to invade Afghanistan, a war we literally just left 20 years on this past, week or two? And then following that, they used the war, they used the 9/11 terrorist attacks to push their own theory that, Osama bin Laden could be hiding in Iraq. Osama bin Laden could be hiding in Iran. We have the Axis of Evil theory come out, where it was really a push to get us into Iran and Iraq. And then you have the Bush administration declaring that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and an attack on the U.S. is imminent and we have to strike now. And these are all conspiracy theories, I should say. Like, the idea that I don't feel, maybe I'm wrong here, but I don't feel like in historical context, these things that the Bush administration put forth are not treated as conspiracy theories. Like, the Bush administration spread straight up conspiracy theories. Hell, I don't even know if obviously some of them knew they were bullshit, so that's disinformation straight up, but I don't know exactly everyone there in the Bush administration knew, but they spread bullshit conspiracy theories and disinformation, and we launched a war in Iraq, and at the end of the day, hundreds of thousands of people, to millions of people, died as a result of these wars based on the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Thousands of U.S. soldiers, hundreds of thousands to millions of Afghan citizens, Iraqi citizens. It is baffling to me that, you know, Josh in the chat says, I think they were just lies. Right. I guess if you know you're straight up lying, they're just lies. But a lot of them were putting forth, conspiratorial bullshit about it, I think. Lies can be justified, I think, probably for the weapons of mass destruction. But other stuff, just based on, like, straight-up conspiratorial thinking, I guess? I mean, we know that Osama bin Laden was hiding in his bunker in Pakistan. I mean, I don't know if you guys remember, but there were these crazy, like, Osama bin Laden's lair. Like, the media was putting together Osama bin Laden's lair photos. I don't know if I could find this, but it was, like, insane to me how some of this stuff was. Here it is. I just found it. Like, we know how he was living, right? In, like, squalor. Like, we have photos now of him, like, with a VHS set in an old tube TV. Like, a tiny little one that, like, your grandparents would set up in, like, your backyard or something. But, like, this is how the media was spreading this shit. Like, look at this. Osama bin Laden's fortress. We know this is not what happened. We know Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden did not have this crazy interior mountain fortress made with multi-levels and stacked to the gills with all sorts of artillery. It's just baffling to me what we, like, put forth here. And you know, it's stunning to me just to see some of this stuff going back now. Like, just the idea that that was something that was published and people believe that. Like, the fervor around 9/11 and the days after, I don't think people really recall it. Like, I was on the Majority Report earlier, and Sam Cedar was on with me. First time in a while, actually, that me and Sam did a whole show together. But, you know, we were discussing just how we remembered it differently, obviously, and how people, callers to the show who were fans of the Majority Report now, were too young to even remember it, which was baffling to us. But for me, I was a sophomore in high school. I had just turned 15. And I remember vividly that day. I remember waking up, getting in my mom's car, and this is not something we usually did. I said to her that morning, and we discussed, oh, what a beautiful September day. Like, I guess we were trying to say we didn't want to go to work. My mom was a first grade teacher at the time. We didn't want to go to work in school. We both were going to school, but we didn't want to go to school. And, you know, it was a beautiful day. There was not a cloud in the sky, blue sky. And I get to school, and we're in biology class, and my biology teacher says, he opens the blinds, he looks out the window, and he says, I don't recall the exact term he used to describe the plane, but he made it seem like it was not like an airline or like something with many passengers. He made it seem, I don't remember if he said it was like a glider or a hangar or something. Like, or at least how I understood it at the time, that moment, a small plane, possibly one, two passengers, crashed into the World Trade Center. And he said, you can see the smoke. Now, I'm in Queens, going to school in Queens. You can see from Queens, the smoke billowing out of the Twin Towers. I did not think it was a big thing. I thought maybe the people on the plane died, maybe people on the floor where it crashed died. You know, that was that. Biology class continued, didn't hear anything else about it. We go to gym class next, and the TVs are all on in gym. And we're sitting, and there was no gym class. They just have us sitting in gym class, and our eyes are on the TV. I remember a girl walking out crying because her father was a firefighter, and I assume she was worried about him. And at this point, the second plane had hit. We could tell it was bad. Now, I was attending a Catholic school. I, as a lot of you know, I was raised Catholic, even though I don't practice any religion now, but I was raised Catholic, went to Catholic school. But the school was at the time, I don't know, maybe it still is, but it is the largest in terms of like attendance and you know, population of students in the country, in terms of like a religious institution school. And there was a worry that at that time that like any place that could have some sort of relevance, even like that, could possibly be a target, because you see the towers get hit, the Pentagon gets hit, and all of a sudden everyone's worried that every sort of building is a possible target. And we were allowed to leave if our parents called to say they were picking us up. And my parents had called to say, give me permission to go home. I went home, and I remember watching TV with my grandma that day. My grandma didn't work. She was who picked us up from school, or when we got older, like when I was in high school. We went to her house to do homework, to do whatever. A lot of my friends lived around her, so, you know, that's where we went. And so me and her watched everything unfold on the TV. And I could see when going home over the highway overpass, the smoke billowing even more. And, you know, everything that I saw has stuck with me. And I've said over the years that if it, you know, I don't know where I would be politically if it wasn't for 9/11. Would I eventually have become a leftist? Would I've, you know, got into progressive politics? Sure. You know, my parents were, my dad was a Democrat. I was already starting to get into politics in, you know, junior high school. I was listening to, like, you know, pop punk or skater punk stuff in, like, you know, in like late 90s, early 2000s when I was in, you know, sixth, seventh, eighth grade. And that ended up being like an opening into more political music. But 9/11 is really what, like, radicalized me at that moment, because it just profoundly affected me. And so after that happened, and, you know, the internet's young in 2001, but there were so many, like, sites where all this was going on, and AOL Instant Messenger, where people were all just, like, talking, and, you know, all sorts of, like, chat rooms and things like that. And I vividly remember going to, at the time, I haven't been to the site in a long time, and I know their politics probably changed over the years, but I remember going to antiwar.com when it became clear what was going to happen. Like, I noticed very early on that the rah, 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 USA, USA, we need to retaliate, we need to, you know, bomb every Arab and you know, turn the Middle East into a parking lot, you know, all those, like, you know, like big bravado USA, America stuff that came after 9/11. I was very aware of that early on. I saw it. I saw it in Queens. In diverse Queens, I saw it. And I could only imagine how it was in other areas of the country. I could only imagine. And I remember reading, and this story has stuck with me. I've told this story on probably the members half of the show before, but let me tell it to all of you. This story has always stuck with me. The murder of Balbir Singh Sodhi, and I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing his name. I've actually, you know, since talking about it previously, I've checked and I've heard his name, but this was a last minute idea to bring up his story to talk about this, but it just so profoundly has affected me over the years that I wanted to bring it up during this show. This is a American citizen who was born, in India. He was a Sikh. He immigrated to the United States in 1989, resided in Los Angeles, worked as a computer engineer and analyst at HP. And one day he saved up enough money and bought a gas station in Phoenix, Arizona, and moved there. And days after 9/11, on September 15th, 2001, a man by the name, a 42-year-old man named Frank Silva Rock, went out looking for Arab or Muslim-looking people to take out his revenge fantasies on because of 9/11. And he saw the Sikh man working at a gas station, and he came and he shot and killed him. Never mind that, you know, the disgusting, you know, grossness of looking for an Arab or a Muslim person who have nothing to do with what went down on 9/11 to kill. But there is an extra layer of just, you know, I don't even know what word to use here, that this guy didn't even have that connection. He was even further removed. This guy just saw, this killer just saw a guy wearing a turban, and he shot and killed him. September 15th, 2001. And Sir Toby says the whole world heard of that one. Yeah, I remember that made news at the, you know, in the ensuing weeks, but I think a lot of people have forgotten about this one. Because, and I know that actually, because what we commonly hear is, I wished we were all united like we were on September 12th, the day after September 11th. And to me, that's another, like, it's another, like, fantasy. It's not really a conspiracy, but it's a fantasy. It's people misremembering how things were, or remembering how it was to be someone who didn't have to worry about being profiled in the ensuing days after September 11th. I mean, I didn't see the pro, you know, the love your neighbor, we're all American unity on September 12th. I saw a lot of people waving flags. I also heard those same people talking about enacting revenge on swaths of innocent people on the other side of the world. I saw and heard of stories like Balbir Singh Sodhi, killed right here in this country, didn't even have to go across the world to hurt somebody. Right here in this country, get murdered just because of how he looked and was profiled for looking like how someone thought 9/11 hijackers should look. You know, so early on, I was very changed. Like, 9/11 sent me on a course. You know, also as someone living in New York, I feel like, you know, the city was never the same. It was never the same. I mean, I remember vividly also as a high school kid, life before 9/11, people literally, you could go to different hangout spots and run into different cliques and groups of people from other schools that you knew, and just everyone was always out. It was like, you know, how it isn't like the old, like, movies where, like, kids were just hanging out in the streets all the time, and 9/11 happened, and I remember how different everything was. I remember me and my, you know, punk rock friends hanging out and walking to the different spots where we used to run into all sorts of people, nobody being there. Nobody being there. And as we talked about early in the Majority Report, you know, this was obviously then compounded by the anthrax scare that happened shortly after, which, you know, like Sam said, we never really found out who was behind the anthrax scare. There was some scientist who was pinned on after his death. I mean, I frankly would not be surprised if that was the case. I feel like sometimes when it comes to stuff like that, it's probably, you know, the Unabomber was just the guy mailing that shit, you know? And this guy, who they believe was behind it, he was like, you know, he worked at, you know, biodefense labs at different military forts, I believe. If I recall correctly, at Fort Detrick, I think it was, or Detrick. So it wouldn't surprise me if that was the case, but we never really found out because the guy died. He never, no one ever came forward. And then after that, obviously, we had the DC sniper, where a guy and this teen he took along were traveling around Washington, DC in a van and literally killing people. This went on for almost a year, if I recall. I think in total, 17 people were killed. All this just like one on top of the other, on top of the other. It was like everything changed. Everything changed. You know, I don't know how much things changed for elsewhere in the country, but in New York, at least, in terms, well, everything changed, obviously, for the country, because what we did in the ensuing, you know, with the wars that I just mentioned. What I'm talking about is, you know, as a 15-year-old in my hometown of Queens, New York, I saw right there quite vividly. Didn't have to watch the news, didn't need to see troops on the ground, didn't need to see how our politics in this country were shaped by either with us or against us. Either for America and everything the Bush administration says, or you're a terrorist. I mean, I saw, you know, quite frankly, just how it was playing out right at home. You know, I'm bringing this all up, obviously, because I want to discuss this stuff. Because I do, like I said, you know, I think 20 years, I feel like going forward, that's sort of, it's going to become, I feel like, less in the moment, thankfully. I think finally people will start looking at it as a historical event and not a present day event. Obviously, ending the wars, the forever wars, is going to play a huge part in that also. But I do feel like, and that's why I wanted to do that this time around. It's the last time, at least for me. Also, probably something to do with my age, you know, 15, taking that all in, and now I'm 35. It's been a big, you know, time in my life of personal growth, and 9/11 being part of that. And I was just sure for many people, you know, if you were 21 at the time, if you were 30 at the time, and now 50, and how this has shaped you in every way. And now back to the conspiratorial stuff. I went off on this tangent, not because, you know, just for the hell of it, but, you know, everything I just said, though, does it sort of sound familiar to all these conspiracy theories we're hearing now? You know, this sense of loss, being lost, that everything around you is changing. You're not in control. You want things to go back to how it was before that moment, and you see people saying that's never going to happen. I mean, COVID. For some people, you know, the election stuff. For other people, QAnon. You know, that's how this stuff spreads. People are looking for an answer for things that they can't, you know, the truth they can't wrap their head around. You know, it's something I've said this before as well, but I truly think 2001 to, like, I don't know, 2004, 5, 6, 7, the Bush years, were true, especially 2001 to 2004, 5, were some of the most depressing years of my life in terms of just how this was all covered and how people went about talking about it. It is why Trump will never stack up to Bush for me. You had the media pushing back against Trump and the Trump administration. You had people coming together to fight back against the Trump administration. It was not taboo to be anti-Trump, in fact, quite the opposite in many circles. 2001, 2002, 2003, you were a pariah if you were not pro-U.S. policy, and not only just that, pro-Bush and the Bush administration. And the media took part in that in every way, shape, and form. I showed you that photo, right? that bunker drawing, Osama's bunker drawing. There was no social media. Like I said earlier, too, the internet was young. There were some communities, but there was no place to, you know, really spread the word. Like, these were niche forums and chat rooms. If you were in there, you were speaking to the choir. It's not like social media or something trends or something gets shared to, you know, a big account shares it to their many millions of followers who obviously aren't in your social circles. So there was no safe space to, you know, to literally use that word in terms of like how dangerous it was to be. I mean, you saw how people were treated. You could just see how, like, celebrities even, they weren't even safe. How they were treated if they spoke out against the Bush administration. The Dixie Chicks are a perfect example. Sam Cedar's old co-host on the original Majority Report on Air America, Janine Garofalo, received serious death threats. She was public enemy number one. Fox News used her as, like, the embodiment of, like, an anti-American, anti-Bush liberal. And it was just a very lonely place for anyone who was against that. And yes, there was a big anti-war movement come, like, 2004, 2003 even, you know, with the Iraq War. Sure, sure. But you have to understand, like, even that big movement was sort of seen as fringe. Like, all those people, was not seen like the Women's March in the wake of Trump. It was seen as, whoa, you know, this fringe is getting a little bit big, a little bit scary how big this anti-American, anti-war fringe is. Like, I saw recently there was like a debate on Twitter about like everyone was like supportive of the Bush administration. And the people on Twitter were like, I wasn't. Well, yeah, I would actually say that the Twitter people are probably right. Because if you're in that political bubble on Twitter, constantly involved in the discourse day in and day out, you probably were very well informed back in 2001, 2002, 2003. And you probably were on the what we know is the right side. The Bush administration lied. And the wars were bullshit. And they never got Osama bin Laden based upon these wars. And it took years later for Osama bin Laden to be found hiding in a little, you know, building in another country, which was one they did not even, the media wasn't even, you know, the reports, they were, he wasn't in Iraq, wasn't in Iran, wasn't in Afghanistan. Like, all those Twitter people probably were the ones questioning it and against it. But the vast majority of this country, man, if you were against the Bush administration's anti-terror policies, I mean, look at the Patriot Act. How would that get through? Come on. If it wasn't for an American, a broad public behind anything and everything the Bush administration was feeding them, and the media lapping it up and spreading it. Let's get back into some more specific conspiracy theories before we head to the second half of the show. Because there were a few I wanted to talk about. You know, you had, like I mentioned, the idea that Iraq or Iran was behind 9/11 and that was used to invade Iraq. You had the inside job conspiracies, the controlled demolition conspiracies. Oh, here was another one that I remember. The idea that there were Jewish people who got the word in advance about, or Israelis, Jewish or, I think both were put forward. And so no Jews who worked at the World Trade Center went in on September 11th because they knew. Obviously, that was bullshit. Obviously, that was an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. Another one, which was used, I guess, you know, people, another example, people looking for answers, that everything's connected in some way. This was like one that was really big online, like the idea that Nostradamus had predicted 9/11. And these were some of the things put forth, I remember. I've found these because I remember them specifically. In the city of God, there'll be a great thunder, two brothers torn apart by chaos. While the fortress endures, the great leader will succumb. The third big war will begin when the big city is burning. And there's another one attributed to him. This one is especially ridiculous because, come on, this is a little bit too on the nose. Come on. On the 11th day of the 9th month, two metal birds will crash into two tall statues in the new city, and the world will end soon after. Well, we all know now that, you know, the world didn't end, but I mean, come on, those first lines, it sounds like someone in modern day writing how they thought some guy hundreds of years ago would talk about these things, right? I mean, come on. These are all bullshit, obviously. The funniest thing is that one of them, I believe, was attributed, as Snopes points out, to Nostradamus in 1654, which would have been a real, I mean, that would have been a real, I'll talk about predictions of what happens in 2001. Him writing this in 1654, to me, would have been the real miracle, being that he died in 1566. And then, you know, you had, what were some other ones? Oh, this one, now, this one has been around for a long time. The Building 7, World Trade Center 7. Now, I've never looked for it. I really should. Let me start. I'm getting ahead of myself. Building 7 has been a long-standing conspiracy. Why did a building that wasn't the Twin Towers, wasn't hit with a plane, you know, why did one of the buildings in the World Trade Center area, Building 7, fall? Now, clearly, when a massive airliner, massive airplane, flies into a extremely large skyscraper, there are large objects, plane parts, building fragments that go flying everywhere. And it never seemed crazy to me that there were going to be damage to surrounding area buildings and surrounding areas. There's going to be debris that falls on nearby buildings. I mean, without a doubt, there are people who died. I mean, for those who don't know, I mean, unfortunately, like I visited the World Trade Center a few times in my life, being a New Yorker, but also being a young, just turning into a high school student. You know, it was right before I started regularly going into the city to hang out with people. I just turned 15, like I said. So it was a time, you know, before I probably would have spent a lot more time in that area, just hanging out if this happened just a few years later. But I had just been there a few times with my family when I was younger. But there was a large, like, I don't know if you'd call it like an atrium or something. Let's put it this way. A couple of weeks before September 11th, my dad went to a concert that was held in that area, like the, you know, the community public park atrium, whatever you call it, between the buildings on the floor, like on the ground level, like outside the buildings. So the idea that people who would be killed or things would be damaged in that surrounding area never seemed out of the weird or out of the blue for me. Now, back to what I was saying. I remember quite vividly. Now, this could have been a mistake from the local news. This could have been, you know, misreporting, or maybe me at 15 years old, you know, sort of, I guess, like a Mandela effect. I really have to go look for this. But I vividly remember at my grandma's house, home from school, watching everything unfold on TV for hours and hours and hours. And sometime in the afternoon, I want to say 3, 4, 5 o'clock, the news reporters on TV said something to the effect that people were worried about the damage sustained to Building 7. And it was no longer, they no longer felt like it was, I don't know, safe or whatever. And this is where it gets hazy for me. I don't remember if they said they were preparing for it to fall, like they knew it was going to happen, or if there was a controlled, but at the same time, how would they have gotten that stuff down there at the time? But I vividly remember them saying something about Building 7. So the idea that even they were confused what was going on then was, you know, not out of the ordinary, but it never seemed crazy to me that Building 7 or any building in that area would sustain damage that would end up having that building fall as well. And then, of course, you had probably what is one of the more long-standing 9/11 conspiracy theories to become a meme at this point, and it's jet fuel doesn't melt steel beams. And listen, I know there's all sorts of things that people put forward about this, but quite frankly, it really doesn't make any sense that a giant plane crashing into a building, fires raging on multi levels of the floor, gas seeping down, you know, fuel seeping down the core of this building, heat at, you know, unimaginable levels, that the structure would be compromised. Like, the fuel doesn't have to completely, like, evaporate the steel beams, like, evaporate the structure of the building. Like, if you're a blacksmith, you're not completely melting what you're working with down to a liquid form. You're heating it just enough to be able to shape it and sculpt it into the shovel, the sword, whatever you are creating. So the idea that the structure, the steel beam structure, would be heated to a level. Remember, it's still holding multiple floors, many people, midsection compromised. So I'm sure things were pushed out of place. That the heat would be so intense and the structure holding all that would be enough for beams to bend, to get bent out of shape, and for everything to implode in the way it did. I mean, listen, the meme is great, because the meme goes all over the place, but the actual belief that, you know, jet fuel can't melt steel beams, I mean, seems like it's taken to the point where, like, these beams had to evaporate or get down to a liquid form. I mean, you can just see, literally go to medieval times, like a Renaissance fair, and see a blacksmith do their work. That steel remains pretty solid while they are able to shape shift it into whatever they're creating. Ferret says, I would think it would topple over. Well, if the middle of the building is compromised, then everything would implode in. And from what I understand, wasn't the structure built to specifically implode? If it was compromised? Psychosi says, I don't know if Matt can see YouTube comments. I can. But the initial energy release of the explosion would be hotter than the subsequent flames. Right, that too. I mean, the idea that the few, I don't even know if they withstood for hours, if I recall. But whatever time they were held up, the idea that the building wasn't compromised the second that was the airplanes crashed and exploded. And that the miracle was they even stood up for that long. I mean, I don't know what people expect. The impact on this, you could just you could see video of it. I mean, to me, the incredible thing was always that they withstood for as they stood for as long as they did after that. I mean, also, this was a structure made if I recall, now I'm not an architect, obviously. But the time period it was made, you know, 60s, 70s, you know, building construction was a lot different then. There was the 1993 terrorist attack on the Twin Towers where a car bomb was set off in the parking lot. And I mean, that was... I mean, obviously they learned from that. The terrorists who wanted to attack the building, who looked at that as a target, learned from that. And the structure wasn't weak from the floor. It was weak from the top, at the top. Did I not say, what did I say, Red Dead Redemption? He's saying, correcting me, parking garage. I think I meant parking garage. There's no parking lots, if I said parking lots in New York City like that. I'll read a few super chats here because I saw Paradise Leia with a super chat. I highly recommend this podcast, The Lead Up and Why It Happened, Blind Spot, The Road to 9/11. Thank you for noting the anti-Muslim sentiment. As a non-Muslim Iranian living in America, changed forever. Right. I mean, I could only imagine. I can only imagine how you felt. Vadim Streams says it was constructed to take plane impacts, but they assumed it would be low altitude planes flying at a low speed, not max speed. Right. The idea that you would, you know, construct something to maintain, to take the impact from accidents or accidental crashes makes sense. There's no way you assume that a massive Airbus or whatever it was would fly at full speed with a tank full of gas purposely into the plane at a strategic, you know, position. To Django Fett says it was designed to withstand the impact, which it did. It wasn't designed to withstand the burning fuel for an extended time. Right. 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 Let's go to, before we go to the second half, there was one or two more conspiracy theories here I wanted to bring up. You know, there was all sorts of ones. I'm looking at a thread of different 9/11 conspiracies. There was the gold heist one. I don't know if you guys remember that. That one I had forgotten about. Where it was said that there was a $160 billion in gold was stored in the World Trade Center, and that only a couple hundred million dollars were ever recovered. So 9/11 was basically a front to cover up a huge gold heist. Obviously, I mean, I think there would have been better ways to go around about that, right? There was another conspiracy, I remember this one, where Flight 93, the one that crashed in the field, didn't reach its destination. They was shot down, you know, by the U.S. I don't believe that's the case. I don't think anything will ever prove that. I do feel like, and I don't, well, I'm not saying this because, you know, but in the way of debunking anything, I do feel like in a lot of sense, it's possible that what actually happened on that flight has been embellished. The idea that the passengers fought back and took over and there was a fight. I mean, we know from various different accounts from you know, phone calls, family members, that there were plans to do something after they heard what happened to the Twin Towers and the Pentagon. But I don't know exactly what happened on that flight, and no one really does. Arbitrary alias brings up another one. There was a conspiracy that Building 7 was filled with CIA documents they wanted to get rid of. I mean, they could have gotten rid of those documents just by shredding them or burning them inside the building without ever drawing attention to anything or anybody. The idea that you would stage a huge terrorist attack to do that, drawing all the attention to those buildings, is ludicrous. Right, Jeffrey Caney on YouTube brings up Let's Roll, right? I don't know what happened on Flight 93. But the dramatization of it in the media and subsequent Hollywood movies always seemed bad taste to me. I mean, again, like, listen, family, the families can console themselves or recover or move on in whatever way they feel comfortable. And if they believe that their family members did what they did, and maybe they did, I totally have no issue with it. But the exploitation of it that we've seen subsequently, where, like, I remember there was, like, Let's Roll merchandise being sold, right? It became like a thing. It always seemed so, I mean, if the terrorists on that flight, if the hijackers on that flight got into that cockpit, that was it. That was it. That was it. If they found out before they got into that cockpit, which we know wasn't the case, I believe, then sure, they could have maybe done something to stop them. But once they were in there, that was it. Now, we can say that the hubbub in the, you know, in the passenger area caused the hijackers to fuck up or stress out or whatever. I don't know. Or want to do something before something went awry to their plans? Sure. But so much of that seemed like propaganda. And to do that to those families and the people who were on those flights, I just thought was horrible. There was no need, especially as soon as it happened. Really, like, the 9/11 media and monetization of it was so quick, so quick. I never saw Flight 93 or World Trade Center or any of those movies. It was so quick. So quick. Like, 20 years on, where, sure, you want to do it, fine. I mean, there's movies of all sorts. If nothing's off limits, obviously. But right after like that, it seemed in such bad taste. Such bad taste. Now, this is one that is, this photo has stuck with me for years. For years. Where is it? I remember, this is like one of the earliest memes. This was like one of the big memes during that time period right after 9/11. The tourist guy. Here, I'll pull it up. Do you guys remember this photo? The tourist guy. Now, the story behind this meme, and I say meme because it was one of the earliest examples of a Photoshop going around the internet, spread everywhere. Everyone was posting this shit. And the story behind it was, well, the fake story behind it was, this was a photo found in the rubble or some shit like that of a tourist who was on the roof of one of the towers, like the observation deck. And this photo just so happened to be snapped as the plane was getting ready to hit the World Trade Center. I mean, besides the point that it looks ridiculous, that plane, I don't even think the plane is of the right scale. The idea that a plane would be flying that close to you and you wouldn't hear it and turn around, I mean, you would have heard that plane coming well before it was even in that position. Like, we're talking, you would have been looking out at it in the distance and saying, holy shit, and running down the stairs to get the fuck out of there, I think. And the perfectly placed, obviously, the perfectly placed date on the right-hand side. Oh, 09.11.01. I mean, I think what later happened, it came out that it was like, you know, obviously it was Photoshopped. And the guy who was in the picture, he was some tourist from like Europe. The photo was taken 40 years before 9/11. He showed the original photo sans the plain Photoshop. Oh, people are saying, and the camera would have survived? People who don't remember this because they were too young. Here's another one. This was a legend, like a urban legend that went around for months and months and maybe even years after. There was a guy or a woman who worked in one of the top floors. And when the tower started to collapse, they grabbed onto a piece of wall or ceiling or just a huge slab of building, of the huge slab of debris that was falling. And they surfed the entire way down and survived. Like, they surfed down on, like, while on this piece of debris, surfed down the imploding rest of the building and lived. I mean, these stories were in abundance. And also, someone's pointing out, right. Like I said, when I was recounting my own day that day, with the tourist picture, it was a beautiful September morning. Blue skies. I don't even think the observation deck would have been open at this time. But this guy's dressed like for a winter New York City visit. You weren't wearing a beanie to the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. I mean, unless you were Tim Pool. But you were wearing a beanie that morning. Oh man, there were so many of those. And I view all these as, you know, obviously conspiracy theories are more, and I've done early on, like the first year of this show, I did an episode with a folklore professor about how urban legends and conspiracy theories, you know, work in tandem a lot of times. Same with fake news and misinformation. Obviously, each has their own difference, but like some of these urban legends really do fall into this territory. Man, there were so many of these urban legends and conspiracy theories. I mean, you could probably do a podcast, like a whole show, a whole podcast, not an episode, a whole podcast on the different shit that came out around 9/11. All the stories of people surviving in the weirdest of ways, and yeah. Anyway, let's go to the second half of the show now. Definitely read that piece I mentioned earlier in The Atlantic. Hopefully for a lot of these families, the 20th anniversary brings some sort of closure for them. Cause I do feel like, you know, 20 years, it's a lot, and we are cutting ties to a lot of the things, the Forever Wars, namely, that I feel like have held us in this never ending post 9/11 world. And I hope we at the very least learned from the many, many mistakes we made. In the ensuing days, weeks, months, years, decades. After 9/11. Paradise says the falling man was devastating. Yeah, that photo. And I know there. The thing around that photo is that I don't think anyone ever discovered who that was. I do believe there's more than one family that claims that could be their loved one. Remember one scenario is that it was one of the chefs at the Window of the World on the World restaurant. You know, I don't think they ever figured out who the falling man was. Right. All right, let's go to the second half of the show, folks. Patreon.com/Matt Binder to support this show. If you can afford to do so, I would greatly appreciate it. If not, support this show in other ways. Subscribe to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Matt Binder, the Twitch channel, twitch.tv/Matt Binder. Follow me on Twitter, Instagram, @Matt Binder. Search for me, Matt Binder, elsewhere on social media. Doomedcast.com for the podcast version of this show. You can please leave reviews at ratethispodcast.com/doomed. There will be links to the various places you can leave reviews. I'd really appreciate if you left a review, if you can. You could leave a one-off donation if you don't want to do a recurring Patreon fee at live right now on the YouTube live stream via Super Chat. I will be taking calls. I'd love to hear people call into the show. We had tons of calls last week. One thing we could talk about is your take on everything I just talked about, re 9/11. You can also call in about other things. I will be getting into other topics as well, maybe, depending on how much time we have. Like I said, last week we had a lot of calls. The call in is you have to open Skype. I will be setting up other ways to call in sooner or later. But right now, you have to open up Skype. It's free. And sign up or log in if you already have a Skype username and just search Doomed Live and call me up. I believe the actual username is Doomed Live _1. Don't know why they added that _1. What else? I think that's it. Again, patreon.com/MattBinder. Really trying to grow the show. And honestly, the financial support helps grow the show more than anything. But again, only if you could financially afford to do so. All right. Other than that, let me thank those new patrons. Don't want to forget about them. We'll never forget about them. To show how much they mean to me, I could never forget about them. What did I do with the window I had open? Here it is. Da, 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 da. When was the last show? Last week, right? Yeah, of course it was last week, but I'm trying to find when the new patrons came in. All right, here we go. Gabriel W., Mikey L., Dean U., Eric O., and Christopher W., thank you so much for supporting the show. Really appreciate it. More talk about conspiracy theories surrounding 9/11 or otherwise in the second half. Calling about other things. I'll be addressing other things too. Lots to talk about. If you're watching live, don't go anywhere. Live stream viewers can stick around. Patrons, of course, can stick around. For people catching the podcast replay, this is where I say peace to you. See you next time on Doom.